Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGBM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgbm.org. Ken Lane is the producer of Desert Oracle Radio. I am not, nor could I ever be, Ken Lane. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, that full moon has been on full display this weekend. I hope you are enjoying it. I bet it means something different to every creature that sees it. Every view is truth to that being, I suppose. In today's episode, Ken is talking about several different experiences of several different creatures, all having to do with the area around Joshua Tree. From September 30th, 2022, here is Famous for Nothingness.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. Our wild paradise, the kingdom of heaven. Out here with the Mojave cottontails and the western gopher snakes and the tarantulas on the prowl. Some creatures think less than us, and some think more. Thinking is the part that generally gets us into trouble. Just look at a raven hanging around the taco shop drive-thru. You're just sitting there wishing there was another place to get something to eat after dark, maybe quietly checking several things on your phone, like something important happened that requires your acknowledgement of it in the 15 minutes since you got in the car. The raven's doing another kind of thinking. But we are people. Sometimes we go astray. That's all right. That's our opposing nature, and we know how to get back on the right road. Not the straight and narrow. The straight and narrow is the highway used by Russian tanks and Amazon Prime double trailer diesels. Look for the crooked road, the crooked beat, the way of the wanderer. That's where, hopefully, we can think about the important stuff. Not regrets, not embarrassment, not another memory of another unpleasant interaction with another equally unhappy person stuck in this same dull, real world. That raven is thinking about how to get some of that food as it passes from the taco shop window to the driver's seat. That's what a lawyer calls actionable. That's what a lawyer likes to say when they're dreaming of buying another BMW. Thinking about the stuff you can change, big stuff, rearranging your life, discarding the situations and belongings which bring you no joy at all. You might recite a sonnet, or a mantra, or a Hail Mary, or the five remembrances of the Buddha. That's a good way to clear out the trash that collects in the front of the head, like bugs in the grill of a car. All that brain power in there, always ready to go into overdrive. We can design and build and successfully launch a spaceship and make the thing intentionally crash into an asteroid, and we can make internal lists of every time we were wronged by somebody, all with the same brain. Last year, one of those influencer travel booklets asked me to write something about Joshua Tree National Park. And as I've lived around here for decades now, and I write about the desert and etc., and especially because they offered a little bit of money for the piece, I wrote up a sort of benediction for people at the end of their Joshua Tree travel experience. Because for everybody who posts a video saying it's a magical place, there's somebody else sitting in traffic thinking, what's the point? Especially in tourist season, which is starting again out here, even though the weather is miserable again. And it costs $100 to fill up the tank again. Who knows what kind of numbers we'll see this time around. Less than last year, probably. A little more space for those who do come out, even though the trend peaked in 2021. Well, the guidebook person did not care for my submission. Apparently, it broke some rule I did not know about, that you can't say anything critical about the place you're writing about. Sort of a 1970s Soviet tour company approach, I guess. So it belongs to me again. And I think it's a relevant sermon for our time and place. But first, let me remind you that this coming week, Thursday, October 6th, at the Poisson Rouge LPR in the West Village, New York City, Desert Oracle Radio, live on stage. Go to lpr.com or desertoracle.com events to get your tickets. They're on sale now, and they're cheaper than most things in the world. Friends, on a busy weekend in winter or springtime when 75,000 people roll into an unincorporated settlement of 6,489 souls because it's the thing to do, you can be forgiven for wondering about the decline of our herd intelligence. Lacking the traditional places to go of most destinations, from parking spaces at the few trailheads to restaurants for dinner, the desert road trip to Joshua Tree mostly takes place inside cars and rental RVs. The most most popular thing to do in the national park tucked between the sprawl of Coachella Valley and the rinky-dink exurban towns of the Morongo Basin is to take a circular drive that returns you to Highway 62 to the north or Interstate 10 to the south. Yes, you can camp in the park, but there are less than 500 campsites across 9 campgrounds, and they do fill up quickly. So for all but a lucky few, the park itself is something you breeze through before returning to your vacation rental, of which there are thousands from Yucca Valley to 29 Palms and everywhere in between. On the busiest weekends, when they're all taken up, the motels and resorts of Palm Springs and other desert cities receive sunburned and road-weary travelers. But the vibe is all about the high desert. The Mojave side of Joshua Tree National Park, with the famed yucca trees and the boulder piles and the perfect homesteader cabins with the cute names and IKEA furnishings and thrift store Chomsky's. Now, we know it's easy to scorn the Instagram JT vibe, which combines the most vapid elements of the past decade's culture, brands, influencers, self-care, fantasy, minimalism, feel-good sloganeering about nature and natives. It's a vibe that means little and goes nowhere, which is why you can rent it for a weekend in the form of a former rental unit that recently housed the low-wage workers who lived here. It's a product. Thoughtful travelers are interested in what the locals do, but what does that mean in a place where locals are outnumbered 10 to 1? Joshua Tree, the unincorporated San Bernardino County area between the retirement community of Yucca Valley and the marine-based town of 29 Palms. Well, they lost 1,000 residents between the 2010 and 2020 census, pushed out by the vacation rental industry. Those who remain are more poor, more white, and more likely to be living in poverty or disabled than their Southern California neighbors. People who rarely, if ever, enter the national park, who don't have hours to wait for a table at a tourist restaurant. Notice the Go Back to L.A. stickers on the locals' vehicles. Those all appeared in the year 2020. When the weather's bad, like it is for half the year, it's difficult to live in this place. Wildfire smoke and Southland haze, the wilting late summer humidity that is rarely accompanied by the monsoon rains of our neighboring Sonoran Desert. Traffic jams on the one real road in or out, it all tests the resolve of the year-round resident. A couple of years into a global pandemic that turned the Morongo Basin into a hot real estate market, not only for Airbnb speculators, but for people escaping the expensive coastal cities forever, it can still be a lonely place. The summertime refuge of our lone movie theater is long gone, seemingly for good. People make excuses to go to Walmart or the Stater Brothers grocery store just to have some air-conditioned place to visit for a while. Only the tourist bars survive the culling of local businesses, and anyone who has walked into the sweltering Joshua Tree Saloon on an August or September night understands that swamp coolers only work when the outside air is dry. The best thing to do is to embrace the good and avoid the bad. No joy will come from the Sunbelt stucco strip malls and second-tier fast food franchises on the highway. You can wear yourself out looking for natural wisdom from the wizened locals because all but a few of them moved here in the 1990s or early 2000s from the suburbs of Los Angeles and Long Beach. The purpose of Joshua Tree, first realized by Pasadena socialite Minerva Hamilton Hoyt when she lobbied her powerful friends in the Franklin Roosevelt administration to create Joshua Tree National Monument in 1936, is to preserve as much of the natural desert as possible for the sake of the desert itself. And for the inspiration it provides to people who live around here, and especially to city people in desperate need of real wilderness. For its first 80 years, the outside world mostly ignored Joshua Tree. Roads were narrow, comforts were few. That's how it was 40 years ago, too, when I began making the trip in my International Scout 4x4 with an army surplus tent and an igloo ice chest in the back. At the Winner's Circle, the old dive bar where Crossroads Cafe lives today, I talk with wild-eyed riders from the San Bernardino County motorcycle gangs and leather-faced rock climbers who specifically enjoyed the lack of people around the boulders. There were bigger and better desert preserves in the Southwest with lovelier views and livelier towns, but Joshua Tree was close to home. SoCal for me back then. And ignored by the crowds who packed Zion and the Grand Canyon at summer vacation time and Easter break and Thanksgiving. The upgrade from National Monument to National Park, completed in 1994 with the California Desert Protection Act, did not bring in the mobs. Visits slowly increased and sometimes dropped again until something like equilibrium was reached in the early mid-2010s with 1.5 million annual visitors. Since then, the tourist traffic has doubled, and Joshua Tree National Park is among the nation's top 10 most visited parks. All those people must be getting something out of it. In a time when few young people can afford houses, especially houses with backyards, part of the attraction is simply having some space for a long weekend. A respite from the sirens, the police helicopters, the public freakouts made worse by the pandemic, the tremendous inequality you cannot ignore in the city. It's probably why so many visitors go overboard and make enemies of their temporary desert neighbors. People crave space. We crave release, and sometimes we forget that the quiet desert landscape carries our drunken voices, magic mushroom epiphanies, and Spotify playlists over many acres of desert. So when you come to the desert, seek some of that quiet for yourself. Add to the quiet if you can. Make time for lazy evening walks down dirt roads and dry washes. That is when you'll see and hear the most wildlife, bushy-tailed coyotes crossing the trail, the ghostly vision of a bobcat disappearing into the brush, the long, weird arms of Joshua trees reaching into a night sky with visible constellations, the distant hoot of a great horned owl. When it's hot, the dawn hour is best for seeing and hearing some of the 250 bird species known to visit or live within the national park and environs. That's when the mammals are still out, when the snakes are sunning themselves. You could always take a midday nap. That's what the animals tend to do. If you're lucky, this desert will do something for your soul. Repair it, maybe, or give it new purpose. The real miracle of Joshua Tree National Park, from the hot Colorado desert side closer to Palm Springs to the pinyon-forested peaks of the Little San Bernardino Mountains near Yucca Valley. The real miracle is that so much of this wild, strange landscape has been protected and set aside, even as a Southern California blob fills in every available space between its mountain and desert boundaries. Boundaries created by public land that has never been more necessary. It's a miracle you can get in on without much effort. Consider Mojave Desert Land Trust, which started up in Joshua Tree just before this area became world famous. That land trust has already acquired more than 100,000 acres of wild desert within, around, and connecting the national park to neighboring national monuments, wildlife corridors, and the mostly untouched land of the military bases that served the beast and the birds trying to survive a hotter, drier, more crowded Mojave. You can make a donation and keep the desert in your heart. Volunteer to clean up desert land, to restore desert plants lost to fire and off-road vehicles. You can be more than a consumer out here if the spirit moves you. This is the vast nothingness full of life we come here for, a landscape that rewards us for letting it be. This here is Desert Oracle Radio with soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Well, it got down to about 97 degrees the other day, and I thought, now I'm going to put up my Halloween decorations. Just a bunch of those signs telling everybody how proud I am of my opinions is just one sign, really. 12 feet wide, 7 feet tall. More of a billboard. And it says, "In this house, we encourage tales of the local Sasquatch and river monsters and haunted old churches. In this house, we honor and occasionally curse our ancestors, and we may occasionally hold discourse with them in our dreams. In this house, we refuse to shun the mysterious and wonderful aspects of life. In this house, the devil better bring a six-pack with his deck of cards. From Amboy to Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness and beyond, this is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from the American desert. From Joshua Tree, from our home station, KCDZ 107.7 FM. And on whatever kind of device you're listening to, it sounds best on the radio. Friends, as we mentioned earlier in the broadcast, this coming week on Thursday night, October 6th, Desert Oracle Radio is coming to the West Village. Tickets are on sale now at desertoracle.com. Just click events or go to lpr.com. One night only, and I'm not hauling stuff to sell, because it's not going to fit in a carry-on, but bring your books if you want them signed. We'll do that after the show. And if you want to support Desert Oracle, which is an unintentional nonprofit, well, we are finally about to open up the subscription sales again. We'll have some news coming up in that department. We're just working out the details, but those of you who've been so patient about the Desert Oracle publication, ye shall be satisfied, I hope. The West Coast Tour begins in Oakland, October 21st, Arcata, 10/22, Portland, 10/23, Vancouver, the Canadian Vancouver, 10/26, Seattle, 10/28, Boise, 10/30, and Halloween night in Salt Lake City. I really just want to sit around and read the Bible and have my coffee and talk to the ravens, but I'm going to do one more of these. I hope to see a good night from the voice of the desert.
Well, as I record this, night has fallen on the cabin too. So I got to get going before I lose that last of that spooky, smoky twilight. It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, 95.9 FM. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that gorgeous full moon. Called the corn moon by some, the changing leaves moon by others, the moon is full September 7th this year. If you have friends along the Oregon coast, they might get to see it as a blood moon in full eclipse. I also found this article on space.com, and the headline is Scientists Capture Interstellar Invader Comet 31/Atlas Growing a Tail. This image is both a scientific milestone and a source of wonder. And the article says, astronomers have captured a stunning image of a tail growing on interstellar invader comet 31/Atlas. The image was captured on August 27, 2025, by a team of scientists and students using the Gemini South Telescope located on Cerro Pachón in Chile. The article, written by Robert Leah, continues, discovered on July 1st by the ATLAS, and that's the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. Boy, that sounds ominous. 31/Atlas is just the third ever object found drifting through our solar system that is believed to have originated from around another star. The previous two interstellar intruders were the cigar-shaped Oumuamua, officially designated 11/2017 U1, discovered drifting through the solar system in 2017, and the comet-asteroid hybrid 21/Borisov, discovered 2 years later in 2019. All of these objects offer scientists a unique opportunity to study material from another planetary system, and the growing tail of 31/Atlas is a tantalizing glimpse at the material that lies within this comet. But this opportunity is limited, as happened with Oumuamua and 21/Borisov. 31/Atlas's orbit will eventually carry out of the solar system. Well, I prefer to call them visitors, not invaders, but to each his own. And of course, here are our nature readings for today from author Kathy Katz in her book, Nature, A Day at a Time, An Uncommon Look at Common Wildlife. Her entry for September 7th begins with a quote, "Don't get caught in the thick of thin things." And that's from Earle Nightingale in Earle Nightingale's Greatest Discovery. And then the entry continues with, "The webs of fall webworms are commonly seen on trees throughout the United States in the fall. Distinct webs of fine silk are created by hundreds of webworms attached to the ends of branches of a single tree. If their tree should be disturbed, the caterpillars respond in unison with jerky but synchronized motions, making the tree look like it's shaking off a pest. Eventually, the small caterpillars emerge as mature adults, white moths that fly at night, meeting other night-flying moths to carry on the next generation of webworms." And then she closes this one with the words of a song you might know. "Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wondering in the night, what were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through?" That's from Strangers in the Night by Charlie Singleton, Edie Snyder, and Bert Kampfert. The reading for September 8th begins, "Before the illegal selling of house finches to bird dealers in New York City, the colorful little bird lived only in the West. In the 1940s, New York dealers released the captive house finches into the wild to get rid of evidence of their illegal activity. And since then, the birds have been spreading westward. They are called house finches because of their ease in adapting to towns and suburbs, one of the traits that appealed to bird dealers. Their genus name is from the Greek meaning fruit biter. The beak of the finch is made for cracking fruits and seeds with hard coverings. Their main food of weeds and thistles is common in city lots and neighborhood yards. And then she closes with this quote, "A rule of thumb says that in birds such as the house finch, color variations occur in local populations, the darker plumage appearing in those that inhabit more humid areas. The naturalized eastern house finches do seem to be darker, and in addition to have larger bills and shorter wings, tails, and legs, and also less variation in their songs than the California race. When and if the two populations meet along some frontier in the West, it may be that there will be two distinct species." And that's from Jake Page and Eugene S. Morton in Lords of the Air. And from Daily Observations, Thoreau on the Days of the Year, edited by Steve Grant, on September 7th, 1851, Thoreau wrote, "I cannot easily buy a blank book to write thoughts in. They are all ruled for dollars and cents." And on September 8th, 1859, he wrote, "I went to the store the other day to buy a bolt for a front door, for, as I told the storekeeper, the governor was coming here." "Aye," said he, "and the legislature too." "Then I will take two bolts," said I. Henry David Thoreau, on August 20th, 1851, also wrote, "A traveler who looks at things with an impartial eye may see what the oldest inhabitant has not observed." I like to think of this newcomer quality as having fresh eyes. So today, here is a reading from Campfire Stories, Volume 1, by Alyssa Koo and Dave Koo, read with permission of the publisher, about Yellowstone National Park, written in 1897 by Charles Dudley Warner. He was a friend of Mark Twain, and he traveled the world and wrote about his experiences. The title of this essay is Editor's Notes 1 and 2. And our reader today is Bill McLaughlin, the host of KGVM Monday Molecule.
A lady said that the central portion of the Rocky Mountain region, that is, Yellowstone Park, is the safety valve of the United States. There are the vent holes of its internal fires and explosive energies, and but for the relief they afford, the whole country might be shaken with earthquakes and be blown up in fragments. There is the smoking and vomiting chimney of the continent. There issue the stream, the hot water in fountains and rivers, the explosive gases, the dissolved and triturated minerals in earths, generated in the incandescent bowels of the earth. I heard a soldier say that if the old faithful geyser did not go off every 65 minutes, he should be alarmed and should fear to stay in that neighborhood, for no one could tell where this suppressed force might not break out. The mountains look pretty solid around here, though some of them, like the Roaring Mountain, which is so full of steam vents that it looks like a hill on fire, do not seem promising places to plant vineyards, if grapes could grow at 7,500 feet above the sea. The great basins of hell, the devil, and other unpleasant names, upon which the steam swirls in clouds, driving over the red-hot ponds and boiling potholes, have usually a thin crust upon which people walk with some courage, but there arises a general want of confidence in the stability of the whole region. It is not encouraging to feel the crust made hot under your feet and to have to be careful not to step into holes of boiling water and fissures of unknown depth, which vomit steam, fat frying kettles, boiling pots of paint and mud, and to have to run away from a cauldron which suddenly sends into the air a great column of hot water. All the world knows, from the pens of 1,000 descriptive writers and from the photographs, the details of these marvels, so that I need not enter upon them, but I suppose their effect is different upon different persons. How beautiful many of the formations are that have been slowly built up by the overflow of these limpid waters, which carry so many salts in solution. What a sense of power there is in the spouting geysers. How exquisite in iridescent colors are some of the burning lakes. How lovely the pools of deep emerald, of sapphire, and the graceful steam floating about over this burning world. But it is hot, and it has a sickening smell, like steam from dirty laundry. I learned to call it the park smell. So constant it is in the hellfire regions. It is exciting to watch for spouting of the geysers and the recurrence of other intermittently phenomena, but many disagreeable things do not intermit. The pools and pots are always boiling. Steams of hot water never stop. And there are steam vents that roar as constantly as blast furnaces. One I recall, which sends out laterally, is from a funnel with an awful roar, a great volume of superheated steam, night and day, year after year, in extravagant rage and prodigality. Steam enough is wasted here to run all the Western railroads. Where does it come from? This one never takes a day or an hour off, like many of the uneasy fryers and spouters in the basin below it. These displays, however, are wholesome in comparison with what is called the mud geyser, which I suppose the most disgusting object in nature. This horrible thing is not in any of the geyser basins, but has a place to itself on the road between the lake and the Yellowstone Canyon. On the side of a hill, at the bottom of a deep sloping pit, is a sort of cave, like the lair of a wild beast, which perpetually vomits a compound of mud, putty nastiness. Over the mouth seems to be a concave rock, which prevents the creature from spouting his filth straight up like a geyser. Against this obstacle, with a thud, every moment, the vile fluid is flung as if the beast were enraged, and growling because he could not get out. And then, through the orifice, the mud is flung in spiteful spits and gushes of nastiness. And the most disgusting part of it is that this awful mixture cannot get out. And the creature has to swallow it again and is perpetually sick to nausea. It is the most fascinating, loathsome thing in the world. I recalled the dragon and his cave in Wagner's Siegfried. There, the reader remembers, is a dark cave, out of which issue volumes of steam and an animal noise. Presently, a dragon protrudes his horrid scaly head and forepaws, and from his jaws come flame and steam. The contrivance seems to have been suggested by this mud geyser. In this geyser, I have no doubt there is a dragon, but he can never get his head out. You can only hear him rage, and you can see the nastiness he vomits out. His horrid scaly head and forepaws, and from his jaws come flame and steam. The contrivance seems to have been suggested by this mud geyser. In this geyser, I have no doubt there is a dragon, but he can never get his head out. You can only hear him rage, and you can see the nastiness he vomits out. Bewildering as all this spectacle is to one's idea of a normal and orderly world, I was more impressed by what I could not see than by these strange surface phenomena. It is what's underneath this thin crust. It is the state of things underground that appeals to the imagination. Where does all this inexhaustible supply of steam and limpid hot water and dissolved salts and paint and liquid mud come from? The crust is hot and trembling. We must be walking amid boiling pots and pits over a terrible furnace. How far below is this furnace? Are these hot substances thrown up from the center? Or is the earth only a little distance under us, all molten and fluid and a raging hell? Why does it not burst up everywhere and blow this whole mountain region sky high? Here and there in this vast territory, one sees frightful fields and ravines of shapeless, contorted rocks, as if in those places the interior had exploded and created and left ruin. And yet, There is a process creation in sight, going on daily and yearly, the slow formation of terraces and mounds and well curbs, all exquisitely sculptured. Now, like lacework, now, like the chiseling of a sculpture. Are these lovely things created only to be destroyed in a great upheaval of this internal force? Will the formations at the Mammoth Hot Springs and in the geyser basin someday, any day, go up in a vast explosion and be destroyed and buried in mud, as were recently the similar terraces and formations in New Zealand? What insurance company would take a risk on these things? In the presence of this immense energy and fiery agitation, we seem to be witnesses of the processes of creation, of the primitive evolutionary forces that are making the planet. Of course, I know that the Earth is not yet created. The lower Mississippi region is now being made before our eyes, as the Nile Delta is. What I should like to know is whether the Yellowstone region is now in process of creation, whether it is to be within certain calculable periods greatly changed in form, or whether we are witnessing now the expiring energies of a world gradually cooling down into rigidity and death. The intermittent geysers would seem to intimate that the internal forces are weakening. The great Excelsior geyser, which was so active in 1889, which shook the whole region when it went off and deluged the neighborhood with an immense flow of hot water and liberated itself by tearing open an orifice of half an acre in area, as its horrible pit of boiling water and steam, and its opening is now so large that it will probably not be able to send up a column of water again. Still, there is no doubt energy here enough to outlast our time and perhaps our nation, and there can be little doubt that this region acts as a safety valve of the continent, which would be shaken with earthquakes if these vents were stopped up.
Well, there's a couple of upcoming events I wanted to tell you about. On Sunday, September 14th, from 12 to 3 p.m., is the Prairie Peace Garden Tour. And this is the last Montana Native Plant Society field trip of the season. And it is north of Tustin. And it will feature a number of native grass and forbs strips in various stages of development, as well as a 500-square-foot xeriscape rock garden that owner Brian Flint would like to share with Montana Native Plant Society members. This is a self-guided tour, but he'll be on hand, and handouts describing various aspects of native gardening will be available. Picnickers are welcome, and directions to the garden can be found at Private Stock Peonies website. And then there's a little bit of Sacagawea Audubon news. The World Wildlife Fund Service Day at the Indreland Audubon Wetland Preserve is Wednesday, September 10th, from 8:30 a.m. to 12 p.m., and the Indreland Audubon Wetland Preserve will host the World Wildlife Fund Conference for a service project morning at the wetlands. They invite other organizations or businesses interested in scheduling a service day to contact them at morgana@bozemanwetlands.org. And then there's a couple of reminders from the National Audubon Society. They're reminding us that every spring and fall, billions of birds migrate through the U.S., the majority of them flying at night, navigating with the night sky. This mass movement of birds must contend with a dramatically increasing, but still largely unrecognized threat, light pollution. More than an estimated 1 billion birds are killed annually from direct collisions with illuminated buildings, towers, and other structures across the country. Light pollution harms birds, but you can help by turning off spotlights and/or decorative lighting, turning off interior lights when leaving a room or drawing blinds and shades, using down-shielded lighting fixtures outdoors, adding timers and or motion sensors to outdoor lighting where possible. And the Xerxes Society reminds us to leave the leaves winter habitat protection. And they say, where do insects and other invertebrates go in the winter? The vast majority overwinter or spend winter right where they spent all summer, just less active and more hidden. So think twice before you rake, mow, and blow this year. Invertebrates rely on fallen leaves and other organic debris to cover and insulate them from the elements. Whatever your landscape, you can ensure that resources for nests and overwintering habitat are available. I want to thank Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the music. A special thanks to Bill McLaughlin and to the authors Alyssa Q and Dave Q from their book Campfire Stories, Volume 1. And to the good folks at KGBM who support and make space for this show. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. Thanks to Gallatin Valley Earth Day and Sacagawea Audubon, to Space.com, to Kathy Katz and Steve Grant. And remember, I would love to hear from you, so call and leave me a text or message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. And finally, I believe that there are places that actually call us if we stop to hear. On that note, here's a song from Beck and Bat for Lashes, and it's called Let's Get Lost. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams, and keep doing good things, and we'll see you next week. Touch me, I'm golden. Wild as the wind blows, I'm tumbling, tumbling, drunk on fascination. Just for tonight, darling, let's get lost. Just for tonight, darling, let's get lost.
I'm waiting for the cue. You're supposed to say the 5-4. Nope.
5-4-3-2.
Nope.